This program is about unsolved mysteries. Whenever possible, the actual family members and police officials have participated in recreating the events. What you are about to see is not a news broadcast.
He fights crime by performing autopsies, and his legendary skills have led some to call him a modern-day Sherlock Holmes. He is forensic pathologist Dr. Cyril Wecht, and tonight we'll accompany Dr. Wecht as he investigates a mysterious and controversial death of a young college student. You will also meet three very unusual investigators, genealogists, who claim that while researching their family trees, they were guided by an unexplained psychic force. It may seem unbelievable, but all three are convinced that the spirits of their ancestors reached out to them from beyond the grave. Join me. Perhaps you may be able to help solve a mystery.
Poor little girl died as a result of being overcome by the flames and carbon monoxide, and that's what killed her. There is no evidence whatsoever to indicate that she had been cut on her throat.
He has been called a real-life Quincy in a modern-day Sherlock Holmes, but by any name, Dr. Cyril Wecht is undeniably one of the country's top forensic pathologists. In court, it is Wecht's testimony that often tips the balance.
To solve a murder and have that case defined to prove that something was not a murder when somebody is thought to have committed a murder. The intellectual challenge is fantastic. The gratification comes from helping people in a very real sense.
In 1993, Seth Floyd was found hanging by the neck in his jail cell. The authorities called it suicide. Dr. Weck proved it was murder. Louis DiNicola spent 5 years in prison for a triple murder. Dr. Weck proved the deaths were accidental, and DiNicola went home a free man. 8-year-old Tanya Palmer accidentally drowned in her own bathtub. At least that's what her mother's boyfriend told police. Dr. Weck helped prove that, in fact, the boyfriend had murdered Tanya Palmer. In law enforcement circles, Cyril Wecht has become something of a legend. But one case continues to haunt him. The mysterious death of a 20-year-old college student near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Perhaps tonight, you can provide the clue that helps Dr. Wecht finally solve this controversial mystery. It was on a Wednesday evening, the 21st of October, 1987, that authorities found the body of Jack Davis, Jr. Davis was sprawled at the bottom of a 20-step stairwell on the campus of Indiana University of Pennsylvania. Jack had last been seen the previous Friday night. He attended a party with some of his fraternity brothers, then made the rounds at a few local bars. Jack's body was autopsied by a local pathologist. A toxicology report, a routine check for unnatural substances in the body, was completed at a lab out of state. The autopsy and test results were forwarded to County Coroner Thomas Streams. He ruled that Jack's death was accidental.
The body was not in disarray from a fight. There was no signs of defensive wounds. As a struggle, there were no drag marks. There was just nothing unremarkable about the body. The scenario was that Mr. Davis wandered down into the stairwell in an intoxicated state, perhaps to urinate, collapsed in an unconscious state, vomited, inhaled the vomitus into his lungs, which therefore then subsequently caused his death.
The official report concluded that Jack Davis died at about 2 a.m. Saturday morning, several hours after he disappeared. His body apparently lay in the stairwell for nearly 5 days.
I couldn't believe or comprehend that he could have died that way. And I was told that was a common occurrence. I found that hard to believe.
Jack's mother, father, and stepmother took him home to Penn Hills, Pennsylvania, and laid him to rest. Even as Jack's family grieved, their doubts about the official findings began to grow. But for more than 2 years, they pushed aside their concerns. Then a local reporter began to publicly question the coroner's ruling. Finally, Jack's family turned to Dr. Wecht.
Thanks for coming down. I'm sorry to meet you under these circumstances.
Before I got into the medical aspects of the case, I was just puzzled as a matter of common sense. How could a body have been lying outside on a college campus in the early fall for 5 or more days, unseen, unnoticed by anybody? The other thing that puzzled me was, I thought, gee, why would a young man in the early hours of the morning walk 15 steps, then a landing, and another 5 steps to urinate? I remember when I went to college, and I remember what young men will do if they have to urinate, especially if they are inebriated, and it's the wee hours of the morning and nobody is around. Not too many people have that kind of discretion and personal sensitivity. So you see, that did not fit either.
We've managed to get a copy of the toxicology report, and we need you to look at this and tell
you
us.
You have that with you?
Yes, I do.
Almost immediately, Dr. Wecht found glaring discrepancies in the report. Although by all accounts, Jack Davis had been drinking heavily on the night he supposedly died, absolutely no alcohol was found in his blood.
There was no doubt that he had been drinking. Nobody challenged that. In order for him to have wound up with no alcohol in his blood at the time of his death, he would have had to have been alive for about 30 hours. The fact then that there was no alcohol in his blood indicates to me that he did not die at that time, you know, when they theorize he had fallen down the steps.
Dr. Wecht found other evidence that argued against a Saturday morning death. Jack Davis was clean-shaven Friday night when he was last seen. But when Jack's body was found, there was heavy beard stubble on his face. There was one final discrepancy, the autopsy slides of Jack's lungs. They provided stunning evidence that the presumed cause of death, choking on regurgitated food, was nothing short of impossible.
If you're going to list that as a cause of death, you've got to find food particles deep down inside the small terminal air passageways, and that wasn't present. The other thing about the autopsy that really stood out for me and made me quiver with excitement was the fact that the head had not been examined. The pathologist who did the autopsy had not opened up the cranial vault.
The pathologist who performed the first autopsy went as far as he felt he had to go to find a conclusive cause of death. And when he opened up Jack Davis's chest and examined the internal organs, he apparently noticed aspiration of stomach contents in the lungs, and therefore he felt that was an independent and conclusive cause of death, and did not open the skull.
At that time, we all agreed as a family and with Dr. Wecht that the body needed to be exhumed.
You can see the discoloration.
It was the only way we would find out the true cause of death.
Look, Joe, look at that subgaleal hemorrhage. What's
that? When I opened up the skull, I found 3 fractures. 3 areas of skull fracture with significant bleeding overlying the brain. It's a blood clot. It's a pooling of blood. And that was the cause of death, which had never been appreciated because the head hadn't been examined in the first autopsy. And now we knew the cause of death. It was then, and is today, of course, unequivocal.
Yeah, you could come in off Oakland Avenue.
Slides and lab work can only tell part of the story. With a university official, Dr. Wecht visited the stairwell where Jack's body was found.
Was some students saw him first then and reported him to the campus?
I realized that that body could not have accidentally fallen or been thrown from high up because he would have had eggshell depressed type fractures. Similarly, it did not appear that he had stumbled down the steps because there was no pattern of abrasions and bruises, contusions, and so that did not fit.
I wonder, Miss Montgomery, if we could possibly get into the building and see from that second floor or even the third, fourth floors, whether one can look out, and then if one did, whether you would be able to look down here.
Right down in
here. Yeah, you can see very clearly. And, you know, if you should look down, you certainly can see directly there on average height.
Approximately 200 students were in rooms overlooking the stairwell during the days Jack supposedly lay below. However, not one person reported seeing the body. There was one final problem with the official scenario, the weather. During the 2 days before Jack's body was found, heavy rain fell on the campus.
Jack's clothes were not wet. We had a real problem in explaining how Jack could have been lying there for all those days in rainwater with dry clothes. Well, how can that be? I would say it is more likely that Jack Davis died elsewhere or was injured elsewhere or was dying elsewhere and then was placed at the bottom of those steps. I base this upon the known facts.
Dr. Wecht's critical findings convinced authorities to reopen the case in October of 1990.
Really, nothing new came of it, and at that point, the investigation was closed again. Personally, I still go along with the fact that he fell from up above. Dr. Wecht's comments about the eggshelling effect, I'm not too sure that he couldn't have hit the side of the wall to begin with and broken the fall somewhat. And I've seen very strange things with drunks anyway, so nothing would be unbelievable to me.
Some critics of the official findings believe Jack's death was no accident. Reporter Marlene Brennan theorizes that Jack may have been caught up in a feud between two rival fraternities.
Some students report that there were up to five fights that night. And it could be possible that he was involved in one of them and he was injured and someone didn't know what to do with him, so they kept him somewhere thinking that he might get better or whatever, and he didn't. And then they moved him into the stairwell.
I believe somebody out there does know something, and I'm hoping that perhaps with continuing inquiries by the family and friends, perhaps through the presentation of this show and so on, who knows, that somebody may step forward.
Had he lived, Jack Davis would have graduated with 2,700 other students in the class of 1989 at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. Cyril Wecht is convinced that among them is at least one person who knows what really happened to Jack Davis, Jr. Perhaps the time has finally come to set the record straight. Next, a remarkable tale of psychic communication from beyond the grave. You're about to meet three very unusual investigators. Genealogists who spent years digging through dusty old books and papers, trying to piece together their family histories. It may sound dry, but these three claim that in the course of their research, they were guided by mysterious forces. Perhaps the spirits of their ancestors, long dead and long forgotten. On a rainy afternoon in 1948, curiosity got the best of an 8-year-old boy named Hank Jones. His basement held a most tempting mystery, an old steamer trunk filled with unknown relics.
opened the lid, and inside was just a treasure trove of material on our family. Old photographs, old letters, documents, old wills and deeds. I never knew any of my grandparents except my mother's mother. And in a sense, by seeing their pictures, by reading their diaries, by looking at their letters, they came alive to me. They became the grandparents I never knew. And I don't know what it was, but it lit a spark inside me at the age of 8. And ever since that time, I've been climbing the family tree, trying to find out as much as I could about my ancestry.
On that chilly day, when he first peered into the old trunk, Hank had no idea he had just set the course for the rest of his life. Today, some 46 years later, Hank Jones is the author of a book, Psychic Roots, and one of the country's leading genealogists, devoted to piecing together long-lost family trees. Tracing his own family has proved one of the most difficult challenges. Hank is descended from a hardy band of German immigrants known as Palatines.
The Palatines were one of the biggest immigrations we've ever had to the New World. And this one little branch of mine started out for the New World, but they ended up in Ireland in 1709 rather than coming on to New York with all the rest of them.
Although his own ancestors had gone to Ireland, Hank found himself intrigued by a man named Johann Dietrich Schneider, who belonged to a group of 847 other Palatine families who had journeyed to New York.
I don't know why, but I felt this almost obsession to find out more about them. So I hired a lady named Carla Mittelstadt Kubitschek to go village to village for me, looking for all these families in Germany. But we had to start somewhere, and I didn't know where to really to tell her to start. And so just off the top of my head, I said, Carla, I don't care. I have no vested interest in any of them. But I've always been interested in a man named Dietrich Schneider who came in this group to New York from Germany. Go look for him first.
In a remarkable turn of events, Hank later learned that he had picked the one person out of the entire migration who was actually related to him.
I don't know how to explain that, but it was just the beginning of a bunch of strange coincidences, strange occurrences that started happening to me as I was studying these Palatine Germans. I would start to dream about them, for instance. At first, the dreams were more about visions of the Palatines' lifestyle. You know, I used to dream about them coming to America, and I could see the ships, I could see them landing, things like that. And then I started dreaming about particular home villages of certain immigrants I was looking for, but I hadn't found yet. So I decided to write down some of the places where the dream suggested I look. And lo and behold, we found about 5 to 7 of those families exactly where the dreams said they would be located overseas.
Could the spirits of Hank's ancestors have somehow reached through the mists of time to lead him to places he would never have thought to investigate? Hank became convinced that was precisely the case. He sent out letters to other genealogists to see if anyone else had had a similar experience.
Well, I got 200 responses, and practically every response started with, I know what you mean, or yes, yes, you've struck a familiar chord. And then they would relate these unbelievable experiences that had happened to them when they were doing their genealogies over the years.
One of the most intriguing responses came from Dr. David Fox, a forensic psychologist in Ontario, Canada. In studying his bloodlines, David became fascinated by his great-great-grandfather, Charles Fox. David learned that Charles had been a sergeant in the British Army in the mid-1800s, during the great colonial campaigns in India and Pakistan. Despite uncovering a wealth of written information, David had no idea what his great-great-grandfather might have looked like, until he began to have a strange recurring vision.
First of all, I pictured him. I pictured him in his military uniform, his red coat, the buttons, and perhaps medals. And then the picture over time started to include his wife and his child, who would be my great-grandfather. And I thought, well, this is very strange because the probability of such a picture existing is so remote, so infinitesimal, you might as well say zero probability.
In 1987, David and a friend traveled to England in search of additional information about David's ancestors.
I want to go look at those figurines.
Right, I'll see you outside in half an hour.
Okay.
Towards the end of the trip, they stop at the Norwich Castle, a popular museum and art gallery in Charles Fox's hometown.
I just wandered from room to room in the castle, aimlessly, I thought. And just as I was entering the doorway to one room, I noticed ahead of me was a very, very large portrait that just stood out almost three-dimensional. I was awestruck. It was like the little hairs on the nape of my neck were just standing up. I had pictured an item somewhat similar to this, or very similar to this, and there it was, right before my eyes.
Incredibly, David says the painting was the same family portrait in his recurring vision.
The painting was completed by one Frederick Sandys in the year 1860. And my great-grandfather, being born in 1857, would have been three in 1860. The woman in the picture was very much younger than the older soldier, and I knew that that Sergeant Charles Fox's wife was 13 years his junior. And the old gentleman was a sergeant. There were three stripes on his right arm. And most curiously and interestingly, he had three ribbons on his left breast. And I realized that my own ancestor probably did win a number of medals when he was overseas, but at that point, I didn't know which ones.
When David returned home, he immediately began searching for confirmation that the man in the portrait was indeed his ancestor. David learned that the medals in the painting had been awarded for the Sutlej campaign, the Punjab campaign, and for long service and good conduct. Those same three medals had been awarded to David's great-great-grandfather, Sergeant Charles Fox.
It's almost as if my head became fuzzy at that time because I thought, this is quite incredible. I had an image, the image in mind, that was translated into something there, something three-dimensional. And again, to have the fantasy and reality merge in this way, I find most exceedingly curious.
The best thing about it is that you have a feeling that your ancestors care about you, that they really want to be found. It's a sense of reuniting.
Carol Montrose of New Albany, Ohio, would certainly agree. While researching her family tree, Carol became particularly intrigued with a woman named Catherine Reddish Stegmeyer, who she believed might be her great-great-aunt. But Carol was unable to find the date of Catherine's death or her final resting place.
Gino, hurry, look.
Then in the fall of 1988, Carol and her son were searching through cemeteries in northwestern Ohio when they came upon a hot air balloon in flight.
Can we follow it?
Sure.
It's going over that way.
So all of a sudden there was a road on my right and I turned and we're sort of following the balloon at this point. And it came down so low that it actually clipped the top of the trees. And all of a sudden, I saw this church with a cemetery across the street, and the balloon appeared to be landing in the back behind the church.
Gino, look, I think it's gonna land over by that church.
But instead of landing, the balloon took flight again. Carol now believes that the spirit of her great-great-aunt had guided her to follow the balloon to this remote church, 150 miles from her home.
I'll be right back.
I thought that it wouldn't hurt to check the cemetery, even though I had never really considered any of the family having been buried there. Almost in the front row was Frederick Stegmeyer, a child of Kate. And I was ecstatic. I mean, I knew that I was in, at least in the right area.
Carol ventured farther into the cemetery. There on the back row was the grave she had been looking for.
It was so amazing, so strange. I can't say for sure Kate was trying to help me, but I sure feel like she was.
I believe it's very possible that the spirits of our ancestors in some way are directing us in our searches. They want to be found. They want to be found, and they may give us little subtle clues along the way of how to do it. They may somehow open some doors for us as we do our genealogy. I'm very open to that.
Did mysterious psychic forces somehow lead Hank, David, and Carol to their ancestors? Or is it all just a coincidence? Whatever the case, if you happen to be studying your family tree and you get that odd feeling to visit one more library or open one last book or even follow a hot air balloon, take heed. Perhaps you are being guided by the spirit of one of your ancestors. When we return, a young woman has disappeared and may be hitchhiking around the country, lost and alone.
Okay, take it out.
August 10th, 1993, just east of Mendocino, California, in a remote corner of Redwood Forest, an incongruous sight. A shiny red car has been found stuck in the mud. The car radio has been ripped out. There are minute traces of blood on the dashboard in the front seat, along with shredded identification papers.
3 years ago.
A few torn up photographs are scattered nearby. The scene appears to bear all the earmarks of foul play, but in this case, nothing is as it appears. The shredded IDs were traced to 22-year-old Christy Krebs, an aspiring chef who worked at two different restaurants in Fort Bragg, California, 7 miles from the spot where her car was found. Christy lived with her parents and two younger brothers in Fort Bragg. And for Christy's parents, the entire scenario had an eerily familiar ring. Christy Krebs graduated from high school in 1989 and went to work full-time in a local restaurant. She was cheerful and upbeat and worked tirelessly, but she also developed an unrealistic obsession about a married man she worked with. On April 30th, 1990, Christy became unnaturally euphoric, fantasizing an imaginary wedding. She drove aimlessly for hours and lost her way on a country road. The car she was driving became hopelessly stuck in the mud. When Christy's car was found, it looked like this. The interior had been totally destroyed by flames. The fire was an almost unheard of freak occurrence, which apparently triggered in Christy a traumatic mental breakdown. The morning after the incident, railroad workers were alarmed by the sight of a dazed and disoriented young woman wandering along the tracks. One of the workmen recognized Christy and telephoned her mother and father, who immediately picked her up.
Initially, we thought things were okay, but as we were driving back into town, the behavior we were getting from her was very bizarre, chanting and patting her, doing very weird things. And I just looked at my wife and said, "We're not going home, we're going to the hospital." I remember in the examining room, she was still acting very, very strange. And for the first week to 10 days at least, she was really incoherent.
We wondered if she was ever going to be the same again. At first, they thought that she might have been on drugs, but they were able to test her and see that there were no drugs in her system.
Hi, kiddo.
Hi, Christy.
Over the next few months, Christy was in and out of the hospital 4 different times.
Where's my
Eventually, she was diagnosed as having experienced a psychotic, trauma-related break.
What? Why are you doing
my
that?
My car. My keys.
Your car's okay.
It's all right,
Christy.
Christy's parents feared the worst. But after therapy and drug treatment, Christy made rapid progress. She was released from the hospital for good some 6 months after the car fire. An occupational therapist had recommended that Christy work, but only part-time.
And good luck to all of you.
I think it was suggested she work 20 hours a week to start with. And she did incredibly well, and she was very proud of herself. And she got herself a second job at a local fast food restaurant. Both jobs were calling her in more and more. And there were often days when she would work 5 or 6 hours at each job. And that would get her anywhere from a 10 to a 12-hour day. Plus, in between the two jobs, she was often going to the health club and exercising and trying to keep her weight down.
3 years went by. Christy's parents became very concerned about her manic pace. Yet Christy insisted she was okay, right up to the night she disappeared.
Here you go.
Great. Thank you.
The manager of the pizza parlor indicated that she was extremely hyper, was extremely happy, much happier than she had been in a long time. And at one point, the manager of the pizza parlor had asked her why she was so happy, which was somewhat unusual. And Christy apparently responded that it's not what you think, and went on about her work.
That night, August 9th, 1993, Christy left work still in high spirits. She said she was going straight home, but she was next seen in the parking lot of a nearby public beach, where a ranger spoke to her about 15 minutes before closing time.
Is everything okay?
Yeah, I just came from work to relax here, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's fine. I just wanted to make sure you knew this wasn't an overnight lot.
Yeah, is it okay if I stay here for a while?
The ranger was the last person to see Christy before she disappeared.
Thanks.
He said that she seemed fairly normal. She then went from there back through Fort Bragg, traveling south, and headed toward the town of Mendocino.
At some point, Christy turned onto a small country road and then veered onto a dirt road. She ended up here, just 7 miles from the spot where the car fire had occurred. Once again, deep in the redwoods, once again, stuck in the mud.
I think that she probably had flashbacks to 1990. It was like reliving that nightmare, and all of that, I think, just overloaded all the circuits.
Christy's father believes that his daughter suffered another psychotic break, perhaps even wandering into a creek as she tried desperately to deal with a bizarre repetition of her earlier trauma.
In my mind, the last thing she did, she went through her wallet in total frustration, whether she's looking at pictures of family and friends, she ripped them all up. She ripped them up and scattered them around. Whether she was destroying her past and trying to get away from it, you know, I really don't know.
The next morning, a full-scale search was launched, but no trace of Christy Krebs could be found. Over the next few months, however, several sightings were reported, from Texas to Salt Lake City, Utah. One sighting in California seemed extremely promising. On June 30th, 1994, an off-duty highway worker named Mike Case stopped to pick up a hitchhiker near Visalia, California, 300 miles south of the spot where Christy's car was abandoned.
It seemed to me that she didn't have it all there. At first, I thought possibly she was on some type of drugs. But talking with her a little bit at the beginning, I knew that possibly she was in a world of her own.
What happened to your wrist there?
I did happen to notice that on her wrist, there was two slash marks on her wrist. And I asked her directly, I said, well, what happened there? And she said, I had a breakdown.
I had a boyfriend. He wasn't very nice.
Over the course of 90 minutes, the girl talked about several things which would later ring true to Christie's parents. A boyfriend who seemed fictional, a desire to visit San Jose where she once had relatives, and especially her love of the ocean. In fact, Mike Case dropped her off at an intersection near Hanford, California, where she could easily hitchhike to the beach. A week later, Mike Case read an article in a trucker's magazine about Christie Krebs' disappearance. He contacted Christie's parents, and they immediately sent photographs.
I went through several of the pictures, and my personal feeling, that was the girl I picked up on the freeway. I'm positive that is her. I'm positive. And I can say that now. I can say it's positive.
I believe that Christie is out there somewhere and that she's alive because Christie is a survivor. She has a lot of strength. She's very friendly. I believe that she would not be a loner, that she would hook up with someone and that she would make sure that she got through this. And I really believe that she has that ability.
We want her back home because we know that with our help, she can once again recover from whatever it is that she's going through. And we really hope somebody out there knows where she is and can help her get home.
When we return, the discovery of a hidden birth certificate prompts a man to search for his long-lost brother.
Mom and Dad's secret papers. As children, most of us knew that our parents kept a treasure trove of mysterious and forbidden items tucked away in a special box or just out of reach in a bureau drawer. For a man named Walter Thomas, this was just such a box, the object of decades of curiosity. Just a few days after his father's death in 1993, Walter finally peeked inside and stumbled on a surprising, unsolved mystery.
It is a ritual that has been repeated by sons and daughters through the ages. Walter gathered the family together and opened his father's stash of private papers.
It's a driver's license, 1933.
Amazing.
Certificate of birth registration for who? John, Philip John Thomas. Who the heck's built a John Thomas?
When we came across his birth certificate, it was the most, it was unreal. I can't think of a word to put into it. It was unreal.
I can't believe this. Daddy never kept anything from me.
It was an extraordinary revelation, one that took Walter back to his childhood in the 1940s. Growing up, he had never heard so much as a whisper about a younger brother named Philip.
All right, is that what you call cleaning up the leaves, huh?
Yeah, honey, come here.
Come here. Give your mama a big kiss.
The Thomas family made their home in Westerly, Rhode Island. Dad worked in a textile mill. Mom looked after Walter, his younger sister, and younger twin brothers.
Oh, what's the matter?
Grandma was a frequent visitor.
What is it?
We didn't have much, but in those days, you didn't expect much. You just did what you had to do just to get by.
You want to try a bottle?
Mom was the sweetest woman you ever did meet. She had a heart of gold. Her laughter lit up the room. She was like a queen to us, you know? She was perfect, in every which way she was perfect, until her sickness came in.
The sickness had been a dark cloud over the Thomas family. Walter says his mother, Adele, suffered strange mental lapses. Without warning, she would wander away from home, trudging aimlessly through the neighborhood and beyond. On many occasions, Walter and his father would spend hours looking for her.
I used to ask Dad that question. Dad, is Mom ever going to get better from this? Is Mom ever going to stop this? His answer was, Sonny, he said, it's in God's hands. I don't know. Sometimes she was happy to see us, and sometimes she didn't even know us.
Mom! Adele? It's me, Walter. You all right?
On several occasions, Adele's condition deteriorated so much that Walter Sr. had no choice but to admit his wife to a hospital. The children were not allowed inside.
And Mom used to come to the window, and she hollered down at us, you know. And
we love you.
Oh, honey, I love you too.
When are you coming home?
I'll be home soon. I promise you, sweetheart, I will. Oh, throw Mom a kiss.
With Adele confined to the hospital and Walter working long hours at the mill, Grandma looked after the children. Not everyone approved of the arrangement.
Is your name Walter?
Yes, sir.
Walter, would you ask your two brothers and sister to come out here with you, please?
Grandma?
Yes?
Hello, Mrs. Thomas.
This is the Thomas household.
We are from the Department of Social Services, and we're here to take Walter Jr., Sarah, Richard, and David to the agency with us.
Inside, Walter.
This home is unfit for these children to continue living in.
Unfit?
My grandmother told them, she said, this Thomas family is a Thomas family. It's going to stay a Thomas family together.
I love these children. You get off my property.
The social service agents were apparently convinced.
My property.
They never again bothered the Thomas family. In May of 1947, Adele recovered and spent several months at home with her husband and children. But another bout of mental illness sent her back to the hospital with an added complication. Adele was pregnant with the couple's fifth child. Philip John Thomas was born in April of 1948. Given the circumstances, Walter felt he had no choice. Reluctantly, he and Adele gave their child up for adoption. Now, decades later, Walter resolved to find his brother, but he quickly discovered that every official record was sealed. His story was picked up by a local newspaper. Then a television station sent a reporter to interview Walter.
Walter Thomas Jr. was 13 years old when his mother...
The broadcast would lead to a completely unexpected discovery. A woman named Phyllis Monroe, who lived just 35 miles from Walter, telephoned with the stunning news that she had known Philip as a child. 3 days later, Walter and Phyllis met.
Phyllis, is that you?
Hi. You're
Phyllis?
You have to be Walter. You look just like Philip.
Hi, honey.
Oh, my gosh.
I can't describe what it felt like to meet her at the time, because so many things in my mind that I wanted to ask her. But when she seen me, you know, she looked at me, she started to cry. She started to cry, oh my God, I said, she said, just when I see you, she says, I see Philip, she says.
He looked exactly like Philip to me, and that's all I needed. I didn't need no paperwork, because that was proof enough to me that that was Philip's brother.
Phyllis, I found the teddy bear. Maybe Philip wants to play with that.
As a child, Phyllis had grown up in a foster home under the care of a woman named Mary Thankful Teft. One of Phyllis's foster brothers was none other than Philip John Thomas. She vividly recalls the few years they spent together.
When Philip came to the house for the first time, he was just dull and just the cutest little boy. He had brown eyes and brown hair. And it was, to me, it was like a brother.
Even the best of foster homes are temporary arrangements, and it was almost certain that Philip and Phyllis would one day be separated. Parting came suddenly in July of 1953. Philip had been adopted.
Philip was part of my life when he was a little boy there. And I know that part of my life went when he went, because I was so attached to him.
Phyllis was able to share with Walter a tangible link to his long-lost brother, this photograph of Philip at about 3 years of age.
to find Philip will close the Thomas family together. It's something that I have to do for my father. My father left me that there. He told me to find him. And not in the words, but he left it there for me to go after him. He knew I would. I'm willing to bet, knowing my father, that he took that paper out many times and touched it and held it and prayed on it and hoped that Philip would have been forgiven enough so that he could, you know, forgive Dad for what he did.
Join me next Friday for another intriguing edition of Unsolved Mysteries. Thank you.